Today on Maine Calling, keeping your pets safe this summer and other veterinary advice. Does your dog just love an adventure, romping through the woods or a field of high grass? If so, veterinarians say remember to do a tick check and make sure Fido is up to date on tick prevention measures. Also, be aware if there are porcupines or skunks nearby. Quills in the snout are painful and one of the most common reasons for an emergency vet visit. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, two veterinarians join us to discuss what maladies and other troubles they are seeing in pets right now, how to prepare your pets for warmer weather, and answer your questions about caring for your furry or feathered best friend. Maine Calling is just ahead. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Caring for a pet can bring great rewards, from companionship and comfort to an excuse to get out and exercise. But pets can also be a source of anxiety and expense. Well, today, veterinarians join me to answer your pet care questions. With us today, Una Wack, who is a veterinarian, a critical care veterinarian in Falmouth. And Una, you're shaking your head. What do I have wrong here?
I'm just a general practitioner. It's Mary that's the criticalist.
Oh, I'm so sorry. And Mary D'Ambrosio, the criticalist veterinarian at the Maine Veterinary Medical Center. Welcome both to you. We invite you to join the conversation, share your comments and questions, send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on social media, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. 1-800-399-3566. Welcome to both of you. I'm going to start by just asking you what you're seeing a lot of. And Una, I'll start with you. It is spring. I know that dogs are outside a lot more right now. Are you seeing an uptick in things like tick-borne problems?
We certainly are. You know, surprisingly, this year, a third of all of our patients are testing positive for anaplasma, and the vast majority of those testing positive are not always clinically sick, but there's been a huge rise in tick-borne disease that we're seeing on a daily basis. Lyme disease, by comparison, might be only about 12% positive. And again, you know, the ticks are out there. I think everyone experiencing a walk in the woods brings home some little creatures with you, and that's quite unlovely.
What's your advice, Una, about how to check your pet for ticks? Because we know that deer ticks are tiny, and obviously your dog is furry. Is there a technique that works best?
Just as soon as you get home, before the ticks have attached, it's good to just do a really thorough tick check. And the ticks will tend to go upwards towards their ears and their face, as well as that's where the dog's pushing through the bushes. They're going to attach mostly to those areas, so their face, chest area. Dogs with nice fluffy ears might be especially prone to swiffering up some little creatures.
All right, Mary, your turn. What are you seeing at the emergency hospital?
Thanks for having me. We are seeing a ton of infectious disease as well. We definitely see a lot of tick-borne disease here. One of the things that we are getting a lot of right now is parvovirus. So we are seeing a ton of parvo right now at our hospital. We're also seeing a lot of cases of gastroenteritis, which is just like a non-specific tummy upset from dogs that are snooting around and eating things that have thawed out from the wintertime, which is pretty yucky. And we're seeing some trauma. We're seeing some trauma cases because pets are out and about and interacting with each other.
All right. And trauma cases can be being hit by a car or having a run-in with a porcupine, right?
Porcupine quills are out and about too. I'm glad you brought that up. We are seeing a ton of quills right now. So definitely porcupine quills are one of the big things we're seeing, and bites from other dogs too.
Oh, is there a time of day in which a dog is more likely to get into it with a porcupine?
That is a really good question. From my standpoint, we see them all hours of the day, but I will say at nighttime, when the dog goes out and they're a little bit more unsupervised and it's dark and you can't really see where your pet is snooting, we do see a lot come through at night. But I think that they're out and about depending on where you're hiking and where you're traveling. They're everywhere.
Una Mary brought up parvovirus. What is that exactly, and how do dogs get it?
It's a viral disease and it affects younger animals and it causes a very severe intestinal disease of almost sloughing the intestinal surface, as well as it does affect the bone marrow, so their immune systems are very compromised. So secondary problems like sepsis are common and it can be a pretty life-threatening disease. There is a good vaccination for it. So this might be an unvaccinated population that we're seeing. I don't think I've seen parvo for years in our practice. But whether that's just kind of an emerging thing as new people are moving in the area, maybe vaccine status might have slipped. So.
And let me ask you this, is parvo something that dogs tend to get from one another when you take them to a dog park or something?
Yeah, it's really fecal oral, so exposure to other dogs' stool that are shedding the virus. And it is a virus that's extremely durable in the environment, so nothing short of bleach will kill it. So it's quite durable and can exist for a long time in the environment.
I want to ask you all about your colleagues, your practice, and I'll start with you, Mary. I know that during the pandemic, it was a very difficult time for the profession, that not just here in Maine, but throughout the country, veterinary practices found themselves under stress because so many people were adopting pets, so many were short-staffed. I know that there has been a mental health crisis among veterinarians, and many left the industry. Do you feel as though things are looking up? Are things improving?
You know, that's a really good thing to bring up. I think the pandemic hit the veterinary field really hard. But in good news, I do think that we are actually bouncing back from it finally. I think that a lot of things have been set in motion. We have Not One More Vet initiative going on, which is specifically targeting suicide among veterinary professionals. We have a lot of mental health awareness amongst I can speak definitely for MDMC, but I think across veterinary medicine, mental health is definitely on our forefront of our minds. We try to make specific time for wellness throughout our days if we at all can. Management is certainly supportive of wellness and just practices for mental health outside of work. So I do think slowly but surely we are bouncing back from that crisis.
And Una, would you agree?
Yeah, I think that's definitely the case. As all places, staffing is always still a challenge, but I do feel that we are able to take a breath now and kind of get our things sorted in a way what we couldn't do before.
Yeah, and all those pandemic puppies, pandemic kittens, are. And I confess I'm one of those people who got a puppy during the pandemic because we lost our other dog. Are those dogs settling in? Are the I know in the beginning it was really sort of chaotic. All sorts of people who never had pets before had them. What is your sense of how those 3-year-old puppies and cats are doing, Una?
I think that because they were missing a lot of that early socialization, there are definitely some behavioral challenges that we're seeing with those pandemic pups. Separation anxiety, especially, is something that is pretty frequent that we come across. And just dogs not being socialized to other dogs or other people, that they might be a little bit more reactive in public. So people are definitely, working hard to work through their dog's baggage and, for the most part, doing really well with that.
Mary, thoughts to add on that?
I would completely agree. I say we have a lot of owners that come in and they say that, they have a pandemic puppy and they're definitely pandemic owners. So we get anxiety, I feel like, on both sides of the spectrum. The puppies are definitely suffering from separation anxiety, and some of them are not very well trained as far as it goes with other dogs. And then same thing with the owners. We have a lot of owners that are very, very attached because they've been so close-knit with their pets over the last few years. I think overall it's a good thing. And I think certainly, you know, the behavioral problems are workable from what I see in the ER standpoint.
I want to circle back, Una, to something we started about talking about, which was ticks. And I asked you how to check for ticks. I understand that in humans, Lyme disease is still much more prevalent than anaplasmosis, but it's the opposite now in dogs.
Yeah, you know, I think dogs are probably functioning as a sentinel in our population, that we're seeing a huge increase in anaplasma rather than Lyme disease. I think part of that too is that, you know, we do have pretty effective tick control for preventing Lyme disease. A lot of the oral tick preventatives will prevent the transmission of Lyme disease, but anaplasma is transmitted in the mouth parts of the ticks, so can be transmitted much faster. And so we're getting a lot more exposure, even if dogs are on appropriate preventatives.
And it can be deadly for humans. Can it be deadly for dogs?
If not caught soon enough, it certainly can. You know, again, the anaplasma can affect the bone marrow. So one of the symptoms that we can see is bleeding, that their platelet count is low. And Mary, that's probably something that you might catch in the emergency room, that some of these dogs come in pretty sick.
Yeah, they come in really sick. Mary, I wanted to ask you a question that I know often comes up, and I'll preempt some of our callers, or maybe they can follow up on more specific questions. But often when a dog or cat or another pet comes to you, it, you know, because it's an emergency, it's something that's going to be expensive. And you all are really faced, I can imagine, with a very stressful situation where an owner feels as though they can't pay for something, but they love their pet. And you recommend pet insurance, correct? And it's not what it used to be, right?
Absolutely. I think that's a really good thing to bring up and talk about. We are huge advocates at our ER for pet insurance because of those unexpected trauma things that happen or illnesses that come up. Veterinary medicine is certainly not an inexpensive thing, and quality care, you know, across the board is getting more and more expensive. Pet insurance is absolutely getting to be very popular. There's a lot of different companies now. It actually just, it's kind of blown up. There's a ton of companies that offer pet insurance, and we don't get any kickback. MVMC, most hospitals don't get any kickback at all for insurance, but we still really support, you know, above board pet insurance by all means, because it really helps take the weight off of those really tough decisions so that you can not focus on the finances, but focus on the emotional, you know, serious life and death decisions that you have to make.
All right. Well, I'm going to start by going to some of our callers with pet questions. We'll start with Ginny in South Berwick. Hi, Ginny. Go ahead.
Hi. Hey, I was just wondering if you might be able to help me with a pretty complex situation. My cat is 11. She's always gone under anesthesia for grooming because she was caught feral when she was just a kitten, and she's just never acclimated to other people. So this time she went under anesthesia and came out with partial paralysis. She could not move her hind legs, and it progressed to maybe a very severe limp where she couldn't run or she couldn't jump, and any weight, you know, just couldn't be held by her hind legs. They told me to take her to Scarborough at Maine Med to see a neurologist. And after two doses of gabapentin, they still could not do a CAT scan or an ultrasound to figure out if it was thrombosis, a slip disc, or maybe from the injection hitting a nerve and paralyzing it. I don't know, but apparently this does happen emerging from anesthesia on occasion, and it doesn't appear that she's in any pain. They said put her in a crate for 6 weeks and keep her dosed up with three doses of gabapentin a day, and I was like, the cat would rather die, so I can't do that. I mean, she's eating, she's being normal. She knows she can't jump, so she's not jumping on her cat tree or on the table. And she doesn't run well. You know, she's feeling vulnerable, but other than that, she's perfectly normal.
So, Ginny, are you looking for some advice of what you might do?
Yeah, like how, Yeah, what might I do to help this cat regain some movement or normalize her movement?
Any thoughts? Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead, Mary.
Yeah, so thanks for calling. I think that's an excellent question. I think this is Mary D'Ambrosio, so I'm one of the criticalists at MVMC. So I think that it really depends on what's going on with your kitty cat. I do worry about it being a thromboembolic event. We see that in cats sometimes where they can have a blood clot that affects their aorta, which is one of our really large vessels in our bodies. And if it's that, then that's a primary heart issue. So we would certainly want to know about that because we could see other things in the future. If it's a paralysis secondary to a nerve problem or a spinal problem, that would be a little bit of a different treatment plan. So it sounds like you were recommended to rest the kitty, which I think is awesome. But ultimately, it sounds like she's going to need to have additional diagnostics done. Sometimes you can try to give the gabapentin at home for a while, like for before, but the day before and the day of an appointment to try to calm her down so that we could perform more advanced imaging with ultrasound or an MRI.
All right. Well, good luck to you, Jenny. We are going to take a quick break. What are your questions for the veterinarians we have as our guests today? The phone number 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainpublic.org or find us on social media. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from the Island Institute. Supporting Maine's fishing families and the communities where they work, join today, islandinstitute.org. Maine Council on Aging, celebrating Older Americans Month by encouraging Mainers to not let age define your limits. And Rennie's, committed to helping you prepare for your next Maine adventure with a variety of Carhartt styles, 17 Maine locations, and at rennies.com.
Artificial intelligence has leapt from the possible to the real so quickly it has taken almost everyone by surprise. AI already is being used to answer customer questions, provide personalized shopping, power our digital assistants, run autonomous vehicles, and more. How else will artificial intelligence impact your job and your life? Is society ready? AI expert Stuart Russell explains on the next Commonwealth Club Radio program.
And join us for the Commonwealth Club this afternoon at 2 o'clock. The 10 is Maine Public's weekly newsletter with our editor's picks of 10 thought-provoking, entertaining, and curiosity-scratching stories from throughout the public media universe. These stories move beyond the week's headlines and will pique your curiosity. If you'd like the 10 delivered to your inbox every Friday, visit mainpublic.org/subscribe.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Today, we are talking about veterinary care with two veterinarians. They are Mary D'Ambrosio with the Maine Veterinary Medical Center and Una Wack with Falmouth Veterinary Hospital. Share your comments and questions. Send an email to talk@mainpublic.org. Comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Una, I wanted to share, well, with both of you, I wanted to share a story that I saw recently on the BBC that a 30-year-old Portuguese dog has been named as the world's oldest ever by the Guinness World Records book. And it's something Bobby is a purebred Rafiero do Alentejo, a breed that has an average lifespan of 12 to 14 years. So anyway, I wanted to ask you, Una, I mean, everybody reads about the kind of dog that they have and thinks, mine is going to live 15 years, 18 years, 20 years. What can we do to extend our dog's life? Or is it like humans? Some are going to live longer than others.
I think, genetics obviously play a big role in that, and also the size and breed of your dog, what their kind of average life expectancy might be. But to optimize that, good preventative care is so important, that having that annual exam to pick up abnormalities. We recommend wellness blood work pretty routinely just to pick up on different things that the dog can't tell you about. They don't have a voice, so we are their advocate. We're hoping to help them have a healthier life.
And is there any breed of dog that you would not recommend people get because you see so many health problems?
Wow, that's a really interesting question. Everyone is pretty passionate about, you know, what they like, but of dogs that we might see a higher incidence of health problems that I highly recommend they get pet health insurance before they leave my room is probably bulldogs, both English bulldogs and French bulldogs. They have a host of different little quirks that can become pretty expensive. And my own dogs, I have some Cavaliers, and they are certainly known to have some health issues also. So health insurance, I think, is a really good idea if you do choose to get some of those breeds with more challenges.
And I have to ask you, what is the oldest dog that you've seen? And I'll ask you, also ask for cat people, what's the oldest cat that you've seen?
I think the oldest dog that I've known was 21. That was a Border Collie. And the oldest kitty, I think 23 was the oldest kitty that I've known.
What about you, Mary?
You know, I think that kind of beats me out, Una. I feel like I probably have seen a dog in his late teens. Maybe I've seen a 20-year-old dog. And then I think I've seen cats probably about that, maybe 21, 22.
All right. An email here from Donna. I'm so disappointed that there is no emergency animal care facility in the Waterville area. I moved from one vet practice to another when they eliminated emergency care, and then that practice eliminated it too. If something happens to my cat, I have to take him to Lewiston or Bangor. The thought of having to take that long drive when possibly every minute counts scares me. Mary, it's a big deal to set up an emergency vet hospital, isn't it?
You know what? It absolutely is. And we definitely feel you, Donna, with that. It is it's a really big deal to set up an ER that's open 24 hours a day. It's expensive. Like Una was saying earlier, the staffing issues are still very prevalent. So we have a hard time staffing our facility to stay open and keeping the lights on 24 hours a day. We so wish that we could extend north, by all means, and to various parts of Maine, but absolutely the frustration is felt on our end as well. And it's definitely a challenge.
If you would like to ask a question of the veterinarians we have with us today, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org. And here is an email from Holly. Our 2.5-year-old female standard poodle is fine in the winter. Calm, normal, and enjoyable. Spring, summer, fall stuff drives herself and us nuts. She spends 6 to 8 hours a day unleashed in the yard chasing black flies, butterflies, moving leaves, and her shadow. When it disappears, she's bonkers with a high-pitched yelping the entire time she's chasing it. She chases anything that moves, worse this summer than last. She's a sweet dog and tries so hard to be obedient, but can't seem to control the running and chasing. Thanks for any help. Una, I'll turn to you.
Oh boy, I feel your pain. I have poodles and they are naughty. So as far as like the chasing flies and shadows and things like that, it sounds like the dog does have a lot of energy. And so having, you know, structured exercise time might be something that would benefit the dog. As well as sometimes if they're allowed to do those behaviors unchecked, they're kind of reinforcing that the shadow went away and they did it. So they're like, yes, I did it. And so sometimes not allowing them to be overstimulated is maybe something that would be beneficial. But it does seem that such an energetic dog might benefit from talking to an animal behaviorist. There's some really excellent ones in the area. And setting up a program at home to sort of be able to manage that dog's behavior, I think, is a good plan. Sometimes medication comes into play, but just turning them down from like an 11 to a 9 is a good idea. And there are some natural therapies available, as well as drugs like Prozac that can take the edge off a bit.
And Una, some dogs just need a lot of exercise, sort of like, you know, maybe 2 1-hour walks or runs a day, correct?
They do. Yeah. My poodles need to run every day or they just stare at me incessantly and then are destructive. So keeping an eye on that is really tough. So
I'm going to go to a message for you, Mary. This is an email from Max. I have a 15-year-old boxer Sharpie mix. Within the past year, she has had a small, soft bump grow under her skin near her eye. It's almost the size of a golf ball. It has grown slowly. I was told if she goes under anesthesia, she may pass away trying to remove it. How high of a chance is that? Overall, she's in great health, still acts like a puppy. Wondering if I should take the chance and see if it's cancer or not, or just let her live her life.
I think that's a really great question and certainly a stressor for all of us when we have to anesthetize an elderly patient. We certainly don't look at age as a disease. And I would definitely recommend that she have a lot of pre-screening evaluation done prior to going under any anesthesia. So that would include x-rays of her chest to make sure she looks good there. Obviously, like a very complete physical exam to find any abnormalities that she may have, and screening blood work to make sure all of her organs are in top-notch shape. But in my opinion, as long as everything is all systems go, I would say if it's going to improve her quality of life, anesthesia has come a long way in veterinary medicine. We do a lot of monitoring under anesthesia, and our medications that we use are overall very safe when they're in the proper hands. So I would say if everything looks good and she's, you know, at your veterinarian that you trust, I would say by all means, if it improves her quality of life, I would recommend having that done.
All right. Una, anything to add?
No, I think that sounds about right. You know, balancing the risks versus the benefits. You know, is this mass annoying her? Is it ruptured? Is it bleeding? Is it getting infected? You know, would it improve her quality of life to have it removed? And if the answer is yes, then I do think it can be done safely.
All right. Let's see here. This is an email from Julia. While everyone loves advice on their pets, please take this opportunity to highlight the extreme staffing shortages and mental health crisis veterinary staff are experiencing. While other professions, teachers, human healthcare, are often praised for being heroes for just doing their job, those in the vet profession are often on the receiving end of abuse and called uncaring because of the costs associated with pet medical care. Veterinarians have one of the highest suicide rates of any profession, and veterinary staff are among the lowest paid workers, yet demand for veterinary services has never been higher. Everyone working in this profession is experiencing severe stress. Please remind people to be kind and patient with their veterinary professionals, not just the doctors, but everyone, including the reception staff and the technicians. Una, I know we've talked about this a little bit at the beginning of the program, but at my vet, there is a sign in the lobby that basically says that, please be nice. And it's really a shame that in this day and age, we have to remind people to be respectful, to be good citizens, to be kind.
Yeah, that's definitely a challenge. I think, you know, people are dealing with heightened emotions and their own stresses and financial stresses. And I can understand that people come in and they want the best for their pet. And understanding that we want that too, and we want to work with you to do that. And being belligerent is not the way to achieve that goal. So, we're really fortunate that I really don't see a lot of that in our practice. But, you know, you can understand that clients definitely have different pressures that we maybe aren't aware of, and just being empathetic to them too and understanding where they're coming from, you know, definitely is something that we try to do every day.
Mary, anything to add to that?
No, I honestly, I completely agree with everything that Dr. Wax said. And I feel like absolutely it is a good time to remind everybody just to be nice overall in general. Definitely in an ER setting, we are seeing people that have a heightened emotional state. They're stressed by all means. And we definitely understand that. So we get that you're upset. And honestly, we are all on team pet. We certainly got into this because we love pets. So we are back there trying our hardest, and we definitely empathize with the client's strife. But I think it's good for all of us to be kind to each other.
An email here. My dog has toxoplasmosis. Can he transmit it to me? And what are the symptoms? Una.
Oh, that's interesting. So that's a little parasite that's usually from eating little animals like mice is how they become infected. And it's passed in the stool of dogs. So unless you aren't practicing good hygiene by washing your hands after dealing with your dog's feces, then it should not be something that's at a high risk for you. But, you know, just as always, washing your hands after dealing with scooping a litter box or picking up your dog's poop is, you know, just common sense.
We'll go to, let's see, Esme calling from Brooksville. Hi, Esme, go ahead.
Hi. I have a black lab named Lucy. She's about 5 years old. She's 90 pounds, like very active, very healthy, voracious appetite. And she lives on Idaho with us. And she recently has had pretty consistent gastric upset that we haven't been able to figure out. She's sort of lives outside all the time, always running around. And she's been eating a lot more grass than normal, vomiting pretty consistently. We did take her in to get some blood work done because we were worried. And her blood work was all normal. But the kind of, yeah, the voracious grass eating to kind of a abnormal level has been a lot higher recently. And so I was just wondering if there are any tips and tricks to kind of support and promote her digestive health right now.
Esme, thank you so much for calling, because I know a lot of dogs like to eat grass and people are perplexed as to why. And also labs in particular will eat anything. So Una, what's some advice for Lucy, for Esme and her lab Lucy?
Right. So with the grass eating, that can be like the chicken or the egg, you know, that they have an upset stomach, so they are more inclined to eat grass, and then eating grass gives them an upset stomach. So if there's a way to prevent her from doing that, that certainly, you know, might be first off. But is there an underlying gastrointestinal issue, like a food allergy, or as you say, you know, labs eat everything. Sometimes we see chronic foreign bodies causing pica, you know, dogs eating inappropriate things. So perhaps the next step might be further diagnostics, like taking an X-ray to see if that might be part of the problem.
And I know, would you recommend, Una, putting your dog on a muzzle when the dog goes on a walk so that he or she won't eat grass?
It is a really good idea. There's some basket muzzles that are available so your dog can pant and drink water and enjoy life, but just can't have access to things that they shouldn't be eating. And those are, you know, a great option for dogs who are eating everything, especially if you live on the island, like little yummy crab legs and things like that probably aren't the best for her digestion.
And Mary, I'll just ask you, because I have to, what is the strangest thing you've taken out of a lab?
Oh, geez. Oh my gosh. We take funny things out of labs all the time. I think, I always think it's kind of adorable when we take out full toys. So I think the funniest thing that I saw come out of a dog, it was a lab and it was a scope procedure. And we took out a rubber ducky, completely intact rubber ducky with a scope. So I thought that was pretty adorable and cute.
Do you, either of you have any idea why they do that? Why they swallow a rubber ducky whole?
I think they're just naughty.
Sometimes I think it's just a mistake, you know, that they're running around and then oop.
Esme, good luck to you and good luck to Lucy. We'll go to Margaret calling from York. Hi, Margaret. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, my Siamese cat loved the Christmas tree, and one day I saw a piece of tinsel coming out of her butt.
Oh.
You know, yeah. But anyway, my question is, do you encourage adoptions of pets, deterring people from spending a lot of money and getting, you know, purebred dogs that might be inbred? And second of all, do you do any volunteer work to help and spay and neuter, you know, animals to stop the, you know, unwanted pets? That's it.
Sure. I guess the first question, purebreds versus rescue dogs. Do you all have any recommendations on the health of one versus the other?
I think, again, we see health issues with rescue dogs as well as purebred dogs. So, you know, I think it's a little bit of an individual thing, but certainly being able to rehome a dog that needs a good home is a lovely thing to do. And happily, we do have some wonderful shelters in the area, both cat and dog shelters, that do a great job at spay-neuter program, as well as outreach to the community to kind of make sure that those animals are put in the forefront so people do have them available.
Thoughts, Mary?
Yeah, I you know, it's funny. I actually just had this conversation with one of my nurses the other day, and we were saying that I think adopting a pet that needs a home is awesome. I agree completely about the health. I think some purebred dogs are known to have some health issues, but we certainly see plenty of mixed breed dogs with pretty serious health issues as well. I love to give a dog a new home if they need it, but I also feel like if you're giving a dog, if they're purchased as a purebred or they're rescued, if you're an owner that's giving a dog an excellent home, I think that's a win-win for the owner and the pet. And then definitely, I certainly approve of the spay-neuter programs. I have not participated in any of those in years. I did used to when I was still doing some surgery, but I haven't done surgery in many years, so I don't participate in that anymore.
Margaret, thanks for your question. If you have a question for the veterinarians on our program today, the phone number 1-800-399-3566. If you're quick, you can send a brief email, talk@mainpublic.org. Comment on Facebook or Instagram. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Evergreen Home Performance, dedicated to helping Maine homeowners improve comfort and efficiency with insulation services. More at evergreenyourhome.com. And Bernstein Scher, lawyers in the business of successful outcomes for their clients. Learn more at bernsteinscher.com. And Center Street Arts Gallery, celebrating 10 years in downtown Bath, open Wednesday through Saturday, 10:30 to 4. Center Street Arts Gallery, LLC.
I'm Scott Tong. With debt ceiling talks ongoing, the clock is ticking till the day the U.S. government cannot pay what it owes. What are the red lines, and who gets hurt first if the country defaults? Next time in Here and Now.
And join us for Here and Now, coming up in about 20 minutes at noon. Every day, Maine Public's news team reports on the issues, events, and ideas that shape our state. You hear our reporting and analysis throughout the day right here on Maine Public Radio, and you can hear a daily digest of those stories on our This Day in Maine podcast. This Day in Maine is available at mainepublic.org and on your favorite podcast app weekday evenings following All Things Considered.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. Today on the program, we're speaking with veterinarians about caring for our pets. My guests are two veterinarians, Mary D'Ambrosio with the Maine Veterinary Medical Center and Una Wack, who is with Falmouth Veterinary Hospital. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page or to Instagram. So many questions coming in. Let's see, I'll go to this one, an email from Ted. One of our two cats recently underwent a minor operation. A hematoma of her ear was drained and the incision stitched up. The stitching required anesthesia to quiet her. Her behavior after returning home, it's been a week and a half, is quite different from the cat she was. She is listless. She used to take an interest in what my wife was doing. She no longer goes on her tears. Her appetite has increased, and she ignores the other cat that she used to enjoy chasing. Is this possibly a result of the procedure on her ear? Una.
That's possible. You know, sometimes cats who have been displaced to the hospital and then coming back, the household takes some time to kind of re-regulate, you know, how they're behaving. It's also possible she might be experiencing some discomfort, you know, if her ear is still bothering her, that she may not be quite herself. But we often see that one cat returning home, that the other cat will act differently to them. And it just takes some time to kind of reacclimate to their home.
When you say taking some time to reacclimate, how much time would you give this cat before you, you know, are concerned that they're not going to reacclimate?
I think, you know, a couple of weeks is not unreasonable, but it can take longer, you know, depending on the cat's personalities and what other factors are going on.
An email here from Al. My Aussie is 15 years old and has lost most of her ability to use her hind legs. She's on Rimadyl and gabapentin. I'm able to take her on short walks using a help along harness, which has been a godsend. During the night, she seems to have panic attacks and tries repeatedly to get up and walk, only to flop back on the floor. During these episodes, she yelps and pants rather loudly. These episodes can last over an hour before she exhausts herself. Needless to say, I often don't sleep much. One might argue that it's time to put her down, but I'm not there yet. Should I ask my vet to add a nighttime sedative to her medications? So, Al, I'm so sorry to hear this. And Una, I'm going to go back to you. I mean, I'm sure this is just a huge part of your practice and your relationship with your patients to try to figure out when is the right time and how to make people feel at peace with their decision. What would you say to Al?
I understand that that's such a hard place to be, and knowing that, you know, dogs just don't live as long as we'd like is one of the great sad things about what we do. But I think talking to his veterinarian about some medication management at night, if during the day he can still have good quality of life and just might need some tweaking at night, it's not uncommon for pets who have some degree of dementia to have kind of sundown nighttime panic attacks. And so, you know, talking to his vet about either adding some more gabapentin or different medications can kind of help smooth that so they can all get some better sleep and some better quality time still.
We'll go to Josh calling from Cape Elizabeth. Hi, Josh, go ahead.
Yes, my question is this. We have a couple of Goldens that we adopted about 3 years ago. They're just 6 years old, and they have the unfortunate habit of eating their own poop. And we have been out there scooping up as quickly as possible. We've tried different things like pineapple juice on their food and things like that. I'm wondering if you have any advice that could deter this kind of behavior. We haven't been able to get a handle on it.
Dogs can be gross, can't they, Una?
Josh, that's a pretty common problem. And so I think you've already tried a lot of things that we might recommend, like adding things to their food to make it taste aversive. Does poop taste good? I can't think that it does. But again, scooping really quickly after they go. And we had mentioned earlier basket muscles are an option. And that's something that could be fitted before your dogs go out, so they just don't have the opportunity to get into stool.
Mary, do you have any thoughts?
No, it's funny, Josh, I have the same problem with mine, and I just try to scoop it as soon as they go out, and sometimes they get to it before me, and I don't know what to make of it.
There you go. The trained veterinarian doesn't know what to make of it either. Thanks so much, Josh. Let's see, we'll go to Lori, who's calling from Otis. Hi, Lori, go ahead.
Hi, I have a Siberian Husky that is a rock eater. And so I'm wondering if there's something lacking in her diet that she might be missing for her to crave rocks, or it just could be anxiety.
Maybe we could do an entire program on what your dog eats. Mary, thoughts about rock eating dogs?
Yeah, I think so. Sometimes definitely it can be a bit of a nutritional imbalance. Sometimes we'll see dogs that try to eat dirt when they have low iron. Or when they're anemic, they can eat dirt, and then subsequently they get a few rocks here and there. So it wouldn't be a bad idea to have some lab work done just to make sure. But I think another one where it's just sometimes they're playing with them and they chew them and then they go, oops, and they just happen to eat rocks as well. I've seen it go both ways. I'd say more commonly is the latter, where they just are a little naughty and they just love to chew and eat rocks.
And I'm guessing that's not really great for their teeth.
No, we do a lot of tooth extractions from dogs that have chomped on rocks. It does fracture their teeth. It's pretty hard. So definitely watch out for your dog's teeth in that case.
Thank you. We'll go on to Patty, who's calling from Harpswell. Hi, Patty. Go ahead.
Hi. I have two dogs that I adopted 3 years ago, Squeeze and Murphy. And Squeeze is a Sato dog, and Murphy is a Rat Terrier Chihuahua mix. He's 13, Squeeze is 7. And sometimes when I walk along, Murphy pulls me over to the car, each 20 pounds. And he pulls me to the car. I hope he wants to go out for a walk, but he runs to the car to get in. And actually, they're out in the car now, sitting out there in the shade. And when I decided I'm going to try to just pull him. He's on a Martindale collar, and make him go. And he puts the brakes on and he won't walk. I've bought harnesses. I've had many harnesses that I end up giving to the pound because he's got a little bit of a beach ball body that we're working on, but he can wiggle out of pretty much any harness. And Squeeze, the Puerto Rican, has luxating knees and a wonky spine, and she's a quirky thing. She's wonderful, but kind of a petrified Puerto Rican dog who's gotten much better, but she too doesn't like to walk. So should I just drag them for a little bit, like gently? I don't quite know what to do to get them to walk.
We've all had that happen when your dog just plants his feet and says, no, I'm not going any farther. Una, thoughts?
Well, you know, I think dragging them isn't going to be fun for anybody. So I don't know that that would be a good solution. Some things that you might try, though, is like not feeding them breakfast in the morning and taking their breakfast portion in a little baggie in your pocket and kind of luring them out and rewarding them for getting a little bit further afield every time. Doing it when they're a bit hungry before they've had breakfast, you know, might be something that will work in your favor. Yeah, good luck with that.
Good luck, Patty. We'll move on to Hollis and Terry. Hi, Terry. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to alert your listeners to a medical, a veterinary problem that I've run into. I took my dog to the Saco River for a swim last year and came home, and she basically collapsed on the floor and was very ill, and we had to rush her over to the emergency vet, and they diagnosed her as marijuana poisoning, THC poisoning. And then this year, I took her for a walk on one of the local trails, and the same thing happened. And we took her back, and it was the same. It was the THC poisoning. So apparently, this is becoming quite a problem, and the dogs pick up residue from a joint or candy or something. It can make them very ill. So I just wanted people to be aware of this.
Mary, how much are you seeing of this?
Oh, yeah. So we see a lot. Generally, it'll be within the household and a known exposure to THC. But a lot of times, yeah, we definitely see the pets that are out on a walk or they're out, you know, just in a well-populated area, and they will pick up some THC. So absolutely, we have been seeing it. For the most part, it's a pretty mild toxicity, but I will say, depending on the concentration and the variant of THC product that they've picked up, it can be fairly severe. So some animals will have to be hospitalized for this. Some animals will have to be decontaminated with IV fluids and IV medications in order to resolve that toxicity. So it's definitely something to watch out for.
Terry, thanks for your call. We're going to move on to Greg, who's calling from Harpswell. Hi, Greg. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Yes, I have a simple question. I was wondering why Maine mandates that, like, my cat get a vaccine each year. I asked for a, what do you call it, mercury-free and aluminum-free vaccine. And they said it has to be given each year. When I was a kid, we got one vaccine, and it lasted for life for rabies. So I'm wondering why we have to get a rabies shot once a year now.
Una.
It sounds like the non-adjuvanted vaccine is only licensed for 1 year. It just does not last as long as the adjuvanted vaccines that are licensed for 3 years. But rabies is really a public health concern that if your cat is unvaccinated, cats do escape outside, animals do come inside. Rabies is a fatal disease that we do need to prevent. So it is important that your cat be vaccinated. And perhaps the different in duration is that the type of vaccine is a more purified vaccine that doesn't last quite as long.
Greg, thanks for your question. We'll move up to Kim calling from MDI. Hi, Kim. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm calling mostly almost like a public service announcement, I guess. Our dog we adopted 2 years ago from Texas. She had a funny limp that we noticed right away. We took her to two or three different vets, actually called your program too. Nobody could figure anything out. Eventually, the limp comes and goes, changes legs. But eventually her eye also went bad about a year ago. And We saw two ophthalmologists, one in Maine, one in Portsmouth, and they didn't figure anything out either, but her eye had to be removed. And then when it was sent, we opted to have it sent to a lab in the Midwest, and they diagnosed a fungal disease, which is really common in Texas, Arizona, some of the Western states, and California. And thankfully, she was diagnosed, so she's now on the right medication, but we're not sure if she's going to make it. She's pretty long into the disease. But what's scary and what I want people to know, I guess, is because so many dogs are coming from those states through these shelters that send dogs up in big vans. And vets here, no fault of their own, nobody knows about this out here. It's very common for the vets to not be aware. So I just want people to be aware, if you have a dog that comes from another place and has strange symptoms, often coughing comes too, but there was no coughing with our dog. So I just wanted to pass it along.
I'm so sorry. And it sounds like it's been such a difficult journey. And Una, I'm wondering if you see this from dogs that have been adopted from other states regularly, that they maybe have a fungus or a virus that isn't common here, but isn't common in other places.
Yeah, we do. You know, people travel away for the winter a lot. And our people who go to Arizona, you know, we pretty commonly check for valley fever, which is Coccidioidomycetes. And it sounds like your dog might have Blasto, which is a fungal disease that can affect multiple organs. And, you know, making sure your veterinarian is aware of your travel history and the dog's origin, you know, that can maybe play a part in what we think of as differentials. But that's a hard one. I'm sorry that you've been through that.
Kim, thank you, and good luck to you. We're almost out of time, so I'm going to ask a pretty quick question here. This is from Catherine. My golden retriever loves to find disgusting things in the woods. He often comes home with portions of a deer leg. Can I let him enjoy his find, or is something like a deer leg not safe for him to eat? Una, I'll let you have that one.
I would take that away from him. Rotten meat and rotten fat can cause pancreatitis as well as gastroenteritis. So it can be quite unappealing and quite dangerous for them to keep that.
All right. Well, that's going to be our last lovely question for the hour. Thank you so much, both of you, for joining us. Una Wack with Falmouth Veterinary Hospital and Mary D'Ambrosio with the Maine Veterinary Medical Center. Today's sound engineer is John Keimel. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. If you'd like to listen to this show again or another Maine Calling show, go to mainecalling.org. That is also the place to sign up for our newsletter. Tomorrow on the program, as part of our year-long series on the changing face of Maine, we turn our attention to people who are new to farming in Maine. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you have been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.